This morning comes from Exodus chapter 14, verses 1 through 31. So Israel's wandering through the desert at this moment. Context. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Tell the Israelites to turn back and encamp near Pi Hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea. They are to encamp by the sea directly opposite Baal Zephon. Pharaoh will think, 'The Israelites are wandering around the land in confusion, hemmed in by the desert.' And I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will pursue them. But I will gain glory for myself through Pharaoh and all his army, and the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord." So the Israelites did this. When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, Pharaoh and his officials changed their minds about them and said, "What have we done? We have let the Israelites go and have lost their services." So he had his chariot made ready and took his army with him. He took 600 of the best chariots, along with all the other chariots of Egypt, with officers over all of them. The Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, so that he pursued the Israelites who were marching out boldly. The Egyptians, all Pharaoh's horses and chariots, horsemen and troops, pursued the Israelites and overtook them as they camped by the sea near Pi Hahiroth, opposite Baal Zephon. As Pharaoh approached, the Israelites looked up, and there were the Egyptians marching after them. They were terrified and cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, "Was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you brought us to the desert to die? What have you done to us by bringing us out of Egypt? Didn't we say to you in Egypt, 'Leave us alone, let us serve the Egyptians'? It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the desert." Moses answered the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand firm, and you will see the deliverance the Lord will bring you today. The Egyptians you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you. You need only to be still." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Why are you crying out to me? Tell the Israelites to move on. Raise your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea to divide the water so that the Israelites can go through the sea on dry ground. I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they will go in after them. And I will gain glory through Pharaoh and all his army, through his chariots and his horsemen. The Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I gain glory through Pharaoh, his chariots, and his horsemen." Then the angel of God, who had been traveling in front of Israel's army, withdrew and went behind them. The pillar of cloud also moved from in front and stood behind them, coming between the armies of Egypt and Israel. Throughout the night, the cloud brought darkness to the one side and light to the other side, so neither went near the other all night long. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and all that night the Lord drove the sea back with a strong east wind and turned it into dry land. The waters were divided, and the Israelites went through the sea on dry ground with a wall of water on their right and on their left. The Egyptians pursued them, and all Pharaoh's horses and chariots and horsemen followed them into the sea. During the last watch of the night, the Lord looked down from the pillar of fire and cloud at the Egyptian army and threw it into confusion. He made the wheels of their chariots come off so that they had difficulty driving. And the Egyptians said, "Let's get away from the Israelites. The Lord is fighting for them against Egypt." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the sea so that the waters may flow back over the Egyptians and their chariots and horsemen." Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and at daybreak, the sea went back to its place. The Egyptians were fleeing toward it, and the Lord swept them into the sea. The water flowed back and covered the chariots and horsemen, the entire army of Pharaoh that had followed the Israelites into the sea. Not one of them survived. But the Israelites went through the sea on dry ground, with a wall of water on their right and on their left. That day the Lord saved Israel from the hands of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians lying dead on the shore. And when the Israelites saw the great power the Lord displayed against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord and put their trust in him and in Moses, his servant. This is the word of the Lord. So do any of you know the song, Going on a Bear Hunt? Yeah, everyone that's ever gone to camp? Yeah? There's a couple variations of it, but it generally goes like this. Going on a bear hunt, gonna catch a big one. I'm not scared. What a beautiful day. Oh no, it's some long wavy grass. Can't go over it. Can't go under it. Can't go around it. Gotta go through it. And the song goes on, you sing that over and over and over again, with different obstacles each time, right? Oh no, a mountain. Oh no, a river. Oh no, a mushroom patch. And I think the people of Israel, if they had camp songs, would probably add, oh no, the sea. Our story picks up after a lot of things have happened for the people of Israel. They have been enslaved for hundreds of years by the Egyptians. God has raised up Moses through some strange circumstances to be Israel's leader. Moses goes to Pharaoh, the Egyptian king, repeatedly and tells him that Yahweh, the God of the Israelites, the only true God, demands that Pharaoh let the people go. But Pharaoh does not. So God sends a series of plagues upon Egypt. Water turned to blood, infestations of frogs and insects and boils, and finally the death of the firstborn son of all Egypt. Finally, after this, Pharaoh relents. The people pick up their things and leave. God goes before them as a pillar of cloud during the day and a pillar of fire at night, leading them through the wilderness. And then our story takes a series of confusing and questionable turns. God tells Moses, turn the people around and go back to where you've just come from and camp by the Red Sea. Pharaoh will think, these people have no idea what they're doing, and I will harden his heart so that he comes after you. Now, if I was an Israelite, this would make me question God's motives a bit. When God, the God who promises to lead you out of slavery, out of the grips of Pharaoh, then says that he's going to make Pharaoh come after you, well, I would maybe start to question God's purposes and intentions. Israel does that a lot in Israel's life, but to their credit, at this point, they do as God says. They turn around. And sure enough, Pharaoh hears word of Israel's escape and their wandering, and he forgets everything he said before. He forgets the pain of losing his son. He forgets the misery the Egyptians have experienced. He's overcome by pride and greed and desire. What have we done? He cries out. And he summons together one of the largest armies in all the ancient Near East. Pharaoh's fleet of chariots alone is enough to guarantee him victory over just about any army anywhere. His chariots set Egypt apart as a great nation. Pharaoh isn't leaving anything to chance. He amasses the entire might of his army, all of his power and strength, to go after this ragtag group of former slaves. Well, it's not hard with all of that power and might for Israel to see the Egyptians coming. They look up, and there over the top of a hill appears what is sure to be their downfall. Had Israel simply had the Red Sea in front of them, things might not have been so bad. There are possibilities when it comes to crossing water. They could take their time and walk all the way around it. They could find its narrowest part and build a bridge or build boats to carry them across. But there's no time for any of that when the entire force of the Egyptian army is bearing down on you. The Egyptians behind them, a sea in front of them. In the proverbial words that arise from this situation, they are stuck between the devil and the deep blue sea. So they cry out to the Lord and complain to Moses, not for the last time, "Did you bring us out here to die? We were better off in Egypt. There at least we had food to eat." When faced with the present circumstances, the past, even one in which the people were slaves, well, that past looks pretty good. The past is known, which makes the past comfortable. The past is safe. When stuck between the devil and the deep blue sea, at least they know the devil they're dealing with. But God didn't take his people out of Egypt just to send them back. "Move on," he says. "There's nowhere to go but forward. Stretch your hand out over the waters, Moses, and I will create a path for you so you can walk safely across." But then notice what God says next. God does not say, "And I will prevent the Egyptians from following you." No, he says, "And I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will come after you." Well, that doesn't really solve Israel's problem, does it? It solves half the problem of the sea in front of them, but the devil behind them still looms large. "Move on," God says, "there's nowhere to go but forward." To which I would probably have responded, "Well, okay, but then what?" I wonder what you might identify today as a Red Sea. Those things that loom before us, presenting an uncertain future. Sometimes looking down the road at all the possibilities before us is exciting, but often it's a little overwhelming. Maybe your Red Sea is the desire to break a cycle of generational trauma. But the idea of confronting loved ones over the pain that they have caused is terrifying. Maybe you are feeling the pull to dive into something, to get involved in your school board or a council or a committee at work, to lend your voice to the important conversations that are going on. But you don't know how you'll be received, or how difficult the work might be. Or maybe you're thinking it's time to branch out into a new career, or to go back to school, or choose a different degree program, or to move somewhere new. And you're just not sure if you're actually cut out for that job, or if you're going to like that new program, or if your family can take the financial hit. It's easier sometimes when faced with a sea, when faced with an uncertain future, to just stay where we are. Because even if we know that there are issues in our families that need to be addressed, or we can't shake the feeling that we could contribute to something, or we feel this tug towards something new, where we are now is a place that at least we know. We know what the walls of this place look like. Where we are might not be where we want to be, but it's familiar, and so it's safe. It's comfortable. It's what we know. Only sometimes we can't stay with what we know. I would say that this church faces a sea in the face of separation. How do you move forward? How do you make plans when you're not sure who's actually here, when there's grief? You can't go back to how things were 20 years ago, 10 years ago, even 1 year ago. But facing the uncertainty of the future is daunting. And looking beyond these walls, what are the red seas that face us as a society? The issues of the day loom large. How ought the church to speak into matters of political violence, war, polarization, economic instability, made? These are not small questions. These are very definite, very big, very daunting, deep blue seas that lie before us. And perhaps it's easier, maybe not to stick with the devil we know, but at least the place we know, to keep our eyes closed, to keep plodding along, hoping that other people might do something, that other people might walk towards those seas, that other people might step out into the sea before us and figure out a way for us to just walk beside. But a day like today reminds us that we can't stay where we are. Because in baptism, we are called into a life that's bigger than ourselves, a life we can only truly experience by going through the waters. You know, in many early Christian churches, baptismal fonts were made to look like tombs. They were dug into the floor of the church, often next to actual physical tombs below the church. And the candidates for baptism would stand on one side and they would renounce the devil and all his ways. And then they would walk down the steps, descend into the baptismal font, into this tomb, to be buried by the waters before they would then rise again on the other side. John Whitfleet writes that in the early church, to baptize literally meant to be drowned, or more freely, to be subjected to the waters of chaos. And consider, in the first few centuries of the Christian church, in an age of persecution, being baptized may in fact have been a death warrant. Someone moving through the waters of baptism would have no way of knowing what the future would hold. And even after Christianity gained legal status, the church has always understood baptism to be a means of initiation into a way of life that includes death. John Calvin wrote, "In baptism, believers are initiated into self-denial, into crucifying the old man, and into bearing the cross. Whenever there is mention of baptism, let us remember that we are baptized under this condition and for this end, to fix the cross to our shoulders." That's not an idea we like to dwell on. We want to be able to promise our children the good life, a life insulated from pain, secure from worry or sorrow. We want to cling to that promise ourselves. All the voices in the air tell us that we deserve to be happy, and that if we aren't happy, we should look for someone to blame or some new product to fix the problem. Everything in life is exchangeable, we're told. Friends, jobs, furniture, church. Baptism calls us to die to this self-focused way of life. Instead, baptism unites us with Christ and his body, and thus calls us into the life of sacrifice, of deep hospitality, of humility, of compassion. Baptism calls us to die to our own comforts and wants and move towards others. Move towards restoration, move towards shalom, even if such a move seems costly. So God calls the Israelites to step into the sea. And as God does, where there once was no way, God makes a way. He causes a strong wind to push against the waters, creating a path of dry, albeit muddy, ground. It must have been terrifying to walk between these immense walls of water. But the Israelites step forward, responding in faith to the call of God. And Pharaoh, of course, goes after them. You'd think that Pharaoh might have gone to the edge of the sea and looked at those swirling walls of water and said, "You know what? I give. You win. I cannot compete with this kind of power." But he doesn't. His heart is so gripped by his own pride and greed that he plunges on after his former slaves. And his pride is his undoing. The very chariots that gave him his military might now break down, their wheels stuck in the mud of the sea bottom. And God closes the walls of the sea over top of them and destroys them. The devil behind was persistent. But in the end, God is the victor. And that is also the promise of baptism. We are called into the waters, called to die to ourselves, called into a life of sacrifice and faith, but with the promise that in dying to ourselves, we are raised with Christ. With the promise that God goes before us in this life, making a way where there seems to be no way. With the promise that we are united with Christ. And it's Christ who, just before he dies, tells his disciples that the life ahead of them will be a difficult one, but encourages them to cling to the promise. He says in John 16, "Very truly I tell you, you will weep and mourn while the world rejoices. You will grieve, but your grief will be turned to joy. A woman giving birth to a child has pain because her time has come, but when the baby is born, she forgets the anguish because of her joy that a child is born into the world. So with you. Now is your time of grief, but I will see you again and you will rejoice. And no one will take away your joy. I have told you these things so that you may have my peace. In this world you will have trouble, but take heart, for I have overcome the world." The devils we know and the seas that loom up before us, God has overcome them. They have lost their power to vanquish us. For even if we suffer, even if we face troubles, even if it seems that there is a long way to go until restoration and shalom, we are finally and ultimately held and protected by the God who passed through the waters of chaos and rose again on the other side. And this is what the Lord says. He who created you, Jacob, he who formed you, Israel, "Do not fear, for I have redeemed you. I have summoned you by name. You are mine. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. And when you pass through the rivers, they will not sweep over you. When you walk through the fire, you will not be burned. The flames will not set you ablaze." This is what the Lord says, "He who made a way through the sea, a path through the mighty waters, who drew out the chariots and horses, the army and reinforcements together, and they lay there, never to rise again, extinguished, snuffed out like a wick. Forget the former things. Do not dwell on the past. See, I am doing a new thing. Now it springs up. Do you not perceive it? I am making a way in the wilderness and streams in the wasteland. The wild animals honor me, the jackals and the owls, because I provide water in the wilderness and streams in the wasteland to give drink to my people, my chosen, the people I formed for myself, that they may proclaim my praise. Would you pray with me? Faithful God, you made a way for the Israelites where there was no way. Help us to move through the waters of our own baptismal callings, responding to the call to die to ourselves that we might live by faith, trusting that you hold us and protect us. So God, go before us to guide us, behind us to protect us, beneath us to support us, and beside us to befriend us. And we will sing with Miriam that you are our God, our strength and our salvation, and we will proclaim your praise. Amen. When the music begins, I invite you to rise in body or in spirit as we sing our song of response. And again, I invite those who are in grades 4 through 6 to rooms 10 and 11 back here for sermon discussion.